Chapter 2. There's a familiar figure in white accented armor waiting in the hallway outside the medical wing, and Jaster quickens his step as he approaches her. He can't help but smile at the sight of masses of blonde hair still pulled into the braid he wove this morning, 14 years of ritual still holding steady despite the recent upheaval. "Arla," he says, and his daughter raises her head from the study of her comm and gives him a crooked smile. "Jaster," she says, "I knew if I lurked here long enough, you'd show up." Not fooled in the slightest, Jaster raises a brow at her, but takes the hands she holds out to him and pulls her in, resting their foreheads together for a moment before he lets her go. "You saw your brother?" he asks. Arla raises a brow right back. "I saw the idiot," she confirms. "He's going to be stuck to that bed until Miles lets him out." "Miles has the sense to keep him in it long enough to heal," Jaster says, unbothered by the thought. "Miles has been his right hand long enough that Django will respect his orders, even if he might not respect Jaster's." "Miles inspires enough fear to keep him in it long enough to heal," Arla corrects, and her smirk makes Jaster snort, conceding the point. When Jaster settles back against the wall beside her, she leans in, lightly bumping her pauldron against his shoulder, and says, "Speaking of Miles, he was saying you brought home a Jedi." "If only my spy network worked as fast as the rumor mill," Jaster says. It's not the first time he's felt that way, and he's absolutely sure it won't be the last. "I found the Jedi who killed Montress on the battlefield and brought him back." Arla's eyes are sharp, thoughtful as she studies him, tugging at the end of her braid. The ribbon is fraying, which means she's been doing that a lot in the last few hours. She always does worry for Django more than she would ever admit. "Did he acknowledge it?" she asks, a little wary. "The life debt." Jaster thinks of the man in his bed, so quiet and so cautious, given to flinching, and Jaster will admit he doesn't like that much at all. But it's early yet. He has time to work out all the little things that cause those reactions and then avoid them. He did, when he was half dead, and then again just now. Arla frowns, looking so much like her brother for a moment that Jaster can't help but smile. "That's something," she allows. "How long until the Jedi Order as a whole comes crashing down on our heads?" Jaster hums, light. "I do wonder," he says, and ignores the exasperated look Arla shoots him. It's good to keep both his children on their toes. Reaching out, he clasps a hand against her vambrace, then pushes away from the wall. "The borders are quiet. No one's made a stink about you technically being banished yet, if that's what you're asking," Arla says dryly, folding her arms across her chest. "Jaster, the order?" "Sorry, Django was asking for me," Jaster says without shame, and hits the button to open the medical wing door. Arla's huff is all exasperation and annoyance. "Old man, keeping secrets stopped being cute when we were 16. The door slides shut before she can finish, and Jaster allows himself a flicker of amusement as he pauses to accept another tub of Bacta from a medical droid. It was most unhappy when Jaster removed John from the medical wing, and it's been calming him reminders about Bacta all day, but, well, Jaster had thought it best not to let Django wake up in the same room as a Jedi, particularly a Jedi who killed Montross. Django's been incredibly set on executing Montross himself, to the point that even Jaster's vendetta took second place. Not that Jaster can blame him. A week of seeing Django in a biobed, pale and unmoving, and Jaster was ready to burn down wide swaths of the galaxy just to get to Montross before anyone else did. Django was the one who carried Jaster back to camp when Montross's betrayal almost killed him. Neither of them is impartial in this. "Keep making Arla mad, and she's going to put a rancor in your bed again," a voice says, rough with disuse, and Jaster turns away from the medical droid's very insistent readout to find the blanket covering the closest biobed has shifted. Django is watching him, looking tired and drawn, but he's conscious, and the wash of relief that sweeps through Jaster is strong enough to make his breath shudder in his chest. "Django," he says, and crosses the space between them in a handful of long strides. Django slides a hand out from under the blanket, and Jaster wraps his own around it, squeezing tightly as he glances up at the readouts above them. They're stable, precisely what they weren't a week ago, and Jaster breathes out, then carefully sinks down in the chair beside the bed. "If your sister can manage to put another half-grown rancor in my bed, she's welcome to," he says. "I still don't know how she managed the first one, but sheer skill must be respected." Django scoffs, then grimaces, pressing a hand to his chest. "Miles finally made you go do your work?" he asks, and Jaster raises a brow at the change of subject but lets it lie. "Yes," he allows, researching new leads as to who was helping Montrose. Django's expression slides into barely contained violence. "When you find him..." "We did," Jaster says evenly. "Montrose is dead." Django freezes, eyes widening. Stares at Jaster for a long moment, then huffs, thumping his head back against the pillow. "Should have saved a piece for me," he says, dissatisfied. "Where was he?" Jaster weighs his words for a moment. One thing to avoid the conversation, but letting Django cling to the wrong conclusion is a little too much like lying, and Jaster refuses to lie to his children. "I wasn't the one who killed him," he says. Something cold slides into Django's face, edged with fury. "Arla?" he asks tightly, though from that tone he already knows the answer. "She said she was aiming for Tor Vizsla, but knowing her..." "No," Jaster says, "it wasn't Arla either." He lets that settle, watches Django's fury rise as he pushes up on one elbow in the bed. "Montrose nearly killed you," he says, a sharp-edged snarl. "He was for our clan to kill." Jaster shifts his grip on Django's hand, pulls. Django hisses in frustration, but lets himself be pushed back down to flat, even though he looks deeply displeased by it. Not unexpected, Jaster thinks, and considers how to frame the news. "The man who took his head killed the entire Death Watch squad Montrose was leading," he says, and Django's brows rise, faintly impressed despite his best efforts. It makes Jaster snort a little, amused, and he sits back, keeping his grip on Django's wrist. He can feel Django's pulse beneath his fingertips, and it's a comfort. "He was alive when I reached the battlefield, and he acknowledged the debt and gave me information on the smugglers who have been helping Vizsla." "That's something," Django says, wary as he watches Jaster's face. "So what aren't you telling me?" Jaster will never complain that his children are too intelligent. Django is tactically brilliant, and Arla has a wickedly sharp mind when it comes to people, and both are great benefits to the true Mandalorians. But at the same time, he sometimes wishes that he could skirt around issues without either of them noticing. Still, telling Django now, when he's forbidden to leave the bed, let alone the medical wing, is probably the best option. There will be plenty of time for him to think things through and come around to Jaster's plan. Hopefully. Or Django will spend the next 2 weeks stewing and erupt into a rage the moment he lays eyes on the Jedi. It's always rather hard to tell with Django. "He's a Jedi," Jaster says evenly, and Django's expression twists. Before he can even open his mouth, though, Jaster raises a hand and says, "Django, a Jedi with his life sworn to me can only benefit us when we move to have the Senate recognize the true Mandalorians as the leaders of Mandalore. Consider the implications." "He's a Jedi," Django snaps. "He should be target practice, not skulking around our base." "I'm going to marry him," Jaster says, and Django's mouth snaps shut. There's a long, long moment of incredulous silence. Jaster holds his son's gaze steadily, unwilling to waver. Despite Django's promise, Jaster is still the Mandalore, and what he says is law. Django can protest all he likes in private, but they'd best have a united front in public, or the Death Watch will try and wriggle into the cracks. "This," Django finally says, "is just your newest plot to get into the Jedi archives." Jaster snorts, but refuses to deny that it's a definite bonus. I'll be expected to go to Coruscant once we officially appoint a senator regardless, he says. That Herodin Jedi witch can't deny access to the spouse of a Jedi. Jedi don't take spouses, Jango points out, but there's a curl of reluctant amusement to his mouth, which was the point. All your grand plans are going to come crashing down when they boot him out of the Order for going along with you. Jaster hums lightly, thinking of scars, of a battlefield under a brewing winter storm. Then we will have another fighter for our cause, he says, and one who killed a whole Death Watch squad single-handedly. There's a flicker of something like reservation, a wariness in Jaster's chest. He doesn't actively wish to remove a Jedi from his order, or strip the man he saved of all ties to his world. But at the same time, Jaster is Mandalore. His people come first. And given the Jedi's skill, Jaster suspects that the Order won't surrender him so easily, which is precisely the best course for Jaster as well. Jango makes a skeptical sound, then winces. He closes his eyes for a long moment, then breathes out slowly as the pain settles, and says, assuming he keeps his word and doesn't just vanish into the night. I have his name, Jaster says, unbothered by the thought. His physical presence as part of this would be helpful, but it's not required. After all, a Jedi on his arm to show off to the handful of clans thinking or suspected of backing the Death Watch will be a perfect silent warning, but just having the Jedi's name beside his on a marriage certificate is enough of a threat of support from the Order. Jaster likes plans with multiple contingencies, and he'd hardly take a different approach in his personal life. At least as much as he still has a personal life. With an unimpressed grunt, Jango waves a hand at him. Go plot somewhere else, he says, and make sure Arla knows not to kill your Jedi. She's trigger-happy. Only when you make her trigger-happy, Jaster says, amused, but he rises to his feet and leans forward. It's a sign of how close a call this was that Jango doesn't protest the kiss on the forehead, and his hand squeezes around Jaster's, far weaker than normal, before he lets go. Montross is dead, Jaster says quietly, and touches his son's cheek. Twice, Montross almost killed him, but the Jedi executed Montross handily, and Jaster's practical enough to still feel the vindication of that action, even if he wanted Montross's head on his own wall. Jango's smile is crooked. Just Vizsla now, he says, and closes his eyes. Jaster doesn't bother reminding him that killing Tor Vizsla will be far, far harder than killing one traitor. Vizsla has the support of far too many Mandalorians for Jaster's comfort, and the civil war is still raging in pockets as the true Mandalorians push the Death Watch back. Jaster's people hold much of the political power, but not all of it. The backing of the Jedi Order, even tacitly, will do more than Jaster can say to change that. Quietly, Jaster leaves Jango to his rest, slipping out of the medical wing before the droid can catch him again. The Bacta in his pocket is already plenty, even with the Jedi's injuries. The medics on Jaster's cruiser did well enough when they patched him up originally. Now all that's left for him to do is rest and finish healing. And after that, Jaster will need to start planning a wedding. Given that they're in the midst of a system-wide civil war, everyone will excuse a small ceremony, even if Jaster is Mandalore. He can make sure all the most relevant figures are in attendance, surround himself with the main force of the true Mandalorians, and be certain that word reaches every corner of the system regarding just who and what Jaster's new spouse is. Having it here on Conquered Dawn would be simplest, assuming the Governor and the Journeyman Protectors are willing to lift Jaster's exile from the planet. They should. The bastard of an officer Jaster killed was proven to be corrupt years ago now, and it's been something of a power play from the Governor, keeping Jaster exiled. Jaster's let it stand, because he did commit a crime, but no more. The war is getting too tight for that much leeway to be given. For a moment, Jaster considers finding Miles and setting things in motion, getting arrangements started, but at the intersection of corridors, he pauses. To the right lie his quarters, and he weighs what needs to be done against the hour, then breathes out, turns. His children are both here, both safe. Django is recovering, and Arla is on guard. And this one night, there's nothing that needs Jaster's immediate attention. He's going to drag a stranger into marriage, going to have a Jedi tie himself to Jaster's life for political reasons, which is already frowned upon in Mandalorian culture. The very least Jaster can do in return is care for him, spend a little time with him. If they actually get along, all for the better. It shouldn't be the difficult decision. The man is clearly a fighter, a warrior, with enough determination to make a Mandalorian proud. Jaster has never encountered a Jedi on his side of a conflict, has only faced them as an enemy and a rival, but he can adjust, rearrange. An in with the Order isn't something Jaster ever thought would be a realistic goal, and yet, here he stands. Montross is a corpse, there's a Jedi in Jaster's bed, and the true Mandalorians may actually manage to secure their position of power in Mandalore's government before the Death Watch or the blasted pacifist movement that's creeping in from the edges can. Mandalorians are meant to fight. Their history is built on a warrior's ways. Jaster would care less about the pacifists if they didn't want to erase all of Mandalore's culture in the process of ending the fighting. Slow, careful, Jaster presses his anger down, waving a hand at the scanner beside his door. The door slides open, perfectly silent, and he stalks through, trying not to let his irritation overwhelm him. Thinking of the Kalevalans and their attempt to reform Mandalore in their image is a sure way to raise his blood pressure, and that annoyance is the last thing Jaster needs when dealing with a wounded man. A wounded man who's no longer in Jaster's bed. Jaster comes to a sharp halt, a sharp whip-crack of suspicion lancing through him as he takes in the bare pillows, the empty tangle of blankets. Django's words about the Jedi disappearing into the night are an unpleasant trickle of suspicion, and Jaster surveys the bed for a moment, then turns on his heel, and stops dead, because the bed might be empty, but the chair in the corner isn't. The Jedi is curled up there, one of the blankets wrapped around himself, bony limbs tucked up in a way that makes him look smaller than Jaster knows he is. There's a book hanging from his fingertips, and he's fast asleep, head pillowed on the curve of the chair's back. Suspicion and budding anger vanish, replaced by a wash of amusement, and Jaster snorts before he can help himself. Quietly, he crosses to the chair, deftly rescuing the book before it can fall and glancing at the cover. It's a history of smithing techniques on one of the planets in the neighboring sector, dry and tedious despite Jaster's general interest in the subject, and he's used it as a sleep aid more than once before. It's no surprise that the Jedi wasn't able to get very far into it either. Marking the page with one of the ribbons on the table, Jaster sets the book aside, then leans down, brushing those stubborn strands of hair out of the Jedi's eyes again. They're black, inclined the faintest hint of curl, and cut so roughly that Jaster suspects the Jedi did the job himself with a vibroblade, and likely without the aid of a mirror. It's amusing, particularly given Jaster's experience with other Jedi, always primly polished and staid to the point of tedium. He's certainly rougher than the Harpy, who refuses to let Jaster so much as set foot in her archives, no matter how many requests he sends to her. "John," Jaster says, quiet, and halfway expects it not to garner a reaction. The name sounds fake, so obviously so that Jaster is inclined to believe it is, but the Jedi stirs like it's enough to rouse him. Pale eyes slide open, immediately flickering to Jaster, and there's a jerk like the Jedi is going to recoil right out of the chair. With visions of what the medical droid will do to him if that happens dancing in his head, Jaster catches John by the shoulder, pins him where he is. There's a full body flinch, like Jaster just swung at his face, and John goes very, very still. A little insulted by the reaction, Jaster raises a brow, meeting John's eyes. "Jedi," he says dryly, "I believe I told you to stay in bed." John swallows, gaze flickering to Jaster's hand and then up to his eyes. "I know," he says hoarsely. "I was just restless. Forgive me." It's not as if Jaster doesn't understand the impulse to get up and wander after an injury. The first time Miles ever yelled at him was over just such an occurrence, and it was the first time Jaster decided he liked the man. With a quiet snort, Jaster shakes his head. "There's nothing to forgive," he says, "beyond the strain on yourself. Here, arms around my neck." John pauses, looking almost wary. "I can walk," he says. Unimpressed, Jaster raises a brow at him. "The medic said tomorrow you may put your feet on the floor," he says. "Until then, I refuse to help you break their rules. Let me carry you back to bed." There's a long, long hesitation as John searches Jaster's face for something that he apparently doesn't find. "All right," he allows finally. "Thank you." "It's not the first time," Jaster points out, amused, and John leans in, carefully, warily sliding his arms around Jaster's neck. With the way he's sitting, it's easy enough for Jaster to get his arms under him, to rise with John in his grip, and there's a sharp, pained breath in his ear that says John isn't nearly healed enough to be up. He buries his face in Jaster's collarbone, breathing rough and ragged, but Jaster doesn't protest. John is long-limbed, muscular, but thinner than he should be. It's lean muscle, pared down to just muscle to the point that Jaster might call it dangerous, but it makes him easier to carry than Jaster would have expected of a man of his size. John doesn't seem to have an answer to that, and Jaster doesn't push, just carries him across the room, then carefully, gently eases him down onto the bed, in the middle of the tangle of blankets, pulls them up, methodical, not letting his eyes linger anywhere in particular, and covers John fully. The medic's warned of the beginnings of frostbite, and Jaster has taken care not to let him get too cold since he was released from the medical bay. "If you want a book," he says, taking a seat on the side of the bed, "I can find you one that's much more interesting than what you were reading. I've struggled with that one myself." "It wasn't bad," John says, pulling the blankets up a little higher. His gaze flickers toward the table in the corner, then back to Jaster, like he's waiting for a reaction. Whatever it is he's expecting, Jaster simply raises a brow at him. "I've encountered sand that's less dry," he says blandly. There's the faintest flicker of humor across John's face, the reluctant curl of a smile pulling at one edge of his mouth. "I've read worse," is all he says, though. He's a Jedi, so Jaster isn't precisely surprised that their texts are as dull as they tend to be. "Yes, well, I hold my books to a higher standard than the Jedi Order does, apparently. What would you prefer? Books on smithing, on history, on politics? I'm afraid my tastes tend toward nonfiction, but I believe Arla enjoys adventure novels if you would like those." There's a long, long pause, but not the kind that says John is torn between his vast array of reading choices. He's watching Jaster, and Jaster watches him in return, thinking again that John looks as wary as a wild animal caught in a trap, caught amidst the trappings of the cozy room, but not used to them. Not what he would expect from a Jedi Knight, certainly. "I would like," John says, low and careful, "to know what you're going to want from me." Jaster stops, a little surprised, meets John's gaze, and that wariness is a sharp thing, edged with resignation. Which isn't a surprise, or shouldn't be, because Jaster has told him nothing, pulled him off a battlefield and immediately set things in motion around him, but not with him. Understandable, perhaps, given his injuries at the time, and easily fixed at the very least. "Forgive me," Jaster says quietly, and can't help but reach out. John's hair is in his eyes again, and rather than simply brushing it back, Jaster smooths his fingers through the strands, then collects them in his grip, braiding them back. "Montross injured Django more than a week ago, and this is the first time I've seen him conscious. My thoughts were elsewhere, and I apologize." John closes his eyes, and Jaster can feel the way he swallows. "I can fight," he says, "but I won't break my oaths as a Jedi, killing the innocent, or executing the unarmed, or..." It is, Jaster thinks ruefully, an entirely reasonable conclusion to come to, given what John knows. "I wouldn't ask you to break such oaths," he says. "The true Mandalorians are mercenaries, not savages. And as skilled as I have no doubt you are, my knight, I had a different plan in mind for you." He settles the braid in John's hair, then sits back, offering John his hands, and when John takes them warily, Jaster pulls him to sit up, steadies him with a hand on his side. "A different plan," John repeats, careful. His voice is a little tight, but more with confusion now, Jaster thinks. Jaster inclines his head. I want you to marry me, he says simply. Killing Montross when I claimed his death means you owe me your life in forfeit. I would have you tie that life to mine and be my spouse. John stares at him, frozen, eyes wide. There's no other response, though, and after a moment, Jaster snorts. You wouldn't be obligated to perform marital duties, he says dryly. I am not that much of a bastard, regardless of my reputation. But I would ask for your presence at formal events, and that you return to my side whenever you are not called on missions. But why? John says, bewildered. He pulls away, just a little, and it looks like he wants to slide out of bed, but Jaster reaches out and catches his elbow before he can. You'll gain nothing. I gain a warrior as a spouse, Jaster corrects, and a tie to the Jedi Order, regardless of how distant. And you gain reinforcements in whatever tasks you are required in, and the resources of the Mandalore behind you. It will not be without benefits on both sides. John doesn't answer, just stares at him, and Jaster huffs out an amused breath. Of course, a mention of marriage would break a Jedi. Even if you refuse to have anything to do with the matter, he says, sitting back to start unlacing his boots, I will put your name beside mine on a marriage certificate. But I would much rather have your actual presence than just your name. Should you truly find me impossible to coexist with, however, I will not object if you wish to flee into the night once you're well again. There's a long, long stretch of silence, but Jaster lets it lie as he strips off his shirt and pants, then rises to find his sleeping pants. When he makes his way back to the bed, John has his head dipped, hiding his face behind the fall of his messy hair on one side. The other side, braided into the rest of his hair, leaves his face bare, and Jaster pauses there, watching him. John's eyes are closed, his face oddly blank, but after several moments, he lifts his head, and pale eyes catch Jaster's without hesitation. I'll stay, John says, soft, and Jaster smiles. Good, he says, and stay there, or my medics will be cross with me. He folds the blankets back, settling on the bed, and pointedly ignores it when John goes stiff. Sleeping in the same bed won't go against the Jedi Order's moral standards, I assume. John swallows, fingers knotting in the covers. No, he says, like it's rote. Jedi aren't celibate. Another long pause, and he slides down, curls up with his back to Jaster, and... Well, Jaster thinks, raising an amused brow. Perhaps Jedi aren't, but at the very least he gets the feeling that John hasn't bedded down with many people, even just for sleeping. Good night, John, he says, and there's a low, rough breath. John's fingers curl in the blanket, tighten, release. Good night, he says in return, so soft that Jaster almost misses it. The wedding will be soon, Jaster says, in the interest of full disclosure. As soon as I can get arrangements in place. We can discuss it more in the morning. John nods, dark hair tangled on the pillow, and Jaster sighs a little, reaching out. He strokes the dark strands, knuckles grazing John's cheek, then turns away, reaches for his own book, waiting on the nightstand, and opens it. There's no protest from John, no request to immediately turn out the light, and for now, Jaster will take it. They can discuss it further in the future, if need be. For now, John is still and quiet on the other side of the bed, curled around his injury like he's protecting himself, and Jaster lets him be, regretting the edge of guilt that bites at his chest, but not enough to give up the advantage that was dropped into his lap. Not enough to alter his plans. This is for his people, and for the sake of their worlds. He can't afford to turn back now. End of chapter 2.